The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April is a story about one man's journey from death row executioner to Lutheran pastor. It's titled The Executioner's Redemption, My Story of Violence, Death, and Saving Grace. You can check it out at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. The Executioner's Redemption is on sale for $12.99. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, The Executioner's Redemption.
This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it.
So what the state has to do is to stamp out dissent, and it has to feed us a steady diet of propaganda to overcome the natural evidence that flows our way.
Pope Francis did say there are absolutely no grounds for considering homosexual unions to be in any way similar or even remotely analogous to God's plan for marriage and family.
The entire person, God and man, descended into hell, conquered the devil, destroyed hell's power, and took from the devil all his might.
Washington jet drivers love Issues Etc.
I used to bemoan the fact that in our society, our educational system, really just kind of the general ethos of modern America, postmodern America, I should say, we're not being taught to think anymore. I'm a product of that system. I was not taught to think. All my thinking was learned remedially as an adult. So I'm speaking from experience. But I've modified my lament. It's not that we're not being taught to think. We are actually being taught not to think. Rather than simply neglecting the simple teaching of what it means to use your mind, your reason, in a proper way, we are being encouraged and taught to abandon reason. So what does a Christian do when we're told that Christianity is illogical? Even some Christians say that Christianity is illogical. Welcome back to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to begin a series on Christianity and logic today, the three acts of the mind. Dr. Gregory Scholes will be our guest. A little bit later, Pastor Tom Baker joins us from Law and Gospel. We will be teaching a Sunday school lesson today, Jesus Teaches Us to Pray, in Luke chapter 11. Dr. Gregory Scholes is a regular guest professor of philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin, author of the book, The Problem of Suffering, A Father's Hope. Dr. Scholes, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. Always great to be with you.
Is Christianity, I guess this is kind of the basic question that we need to get out of the way, is Christianity itself logical?
Well, we get to talk about a distinction there, I suppose, right from the start. So we have an understanding among us as Lutheran folks that we want to practice things of reason, using reason in a ministerial sense rather than a magisterial sense. So the understanding and recognition there is that we always want to use this powerful gift of reasoning in service to God and His revealed word in the Bible, and never acting as, we'd say in Latin, as the magister or as the teacher of His word. I think it's also the case that we need to recover a robust and maybe even kind of aggressive recognition that Jesus is revealed in the opening of John's Gospel as the Logos, and from already the Greek times, Logos was informing that word logic. So I think we'd have to say that Christianity is Logos-like, and certainly in that very rich, biblically informed sense is logical.
So just to kind of turn that question around to help clarify your answer there, what would you say to someone who says, well, Christianity is a matter of faith. It is illogical. It is irrational.
Yeah, the term irrational is a pretty prejudicial one. So I'd suggest to that person that he or she needs to acquire a little bit more careful and bigger vocabulary. So maybe we would accept as a starting point that Christianity is non-rational in the sense that we certainly can't reason our way to God and to salvation in Him. That has to come from Him. As St. Paul says, faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the Word of God. So it's at least not irrational, and rather could be called perhaps non-rational. But I think we also want to quibble with that when we've got God saying things such as he does through Isaiah, come, let us reason together. I don't think we want to give up the field at all. So our faith from and in Christ doesn't come as the result of our hard work on reasoning or logic, but it doesn't follow from that that it's illogical or unreasonable.
We can't really have this entire conversation of this series without acknowledging the kind of the current way that's very strongly influential, not only in academia, but all throughout our culture and our society, the current way that people are taught not to think that we call postmodernism. How would you describe it?
Yeah. Well, normally, Todd, that's a question that I have to stop and talk about in some detail and with some quotes from the postmod thinkers, because as you suggested, my Christian foundation, which I take to be the absolute truth of things in our Lord Christ, that automatically makes me suspicious of and opposed to corrosive postmodernism. But how about if we say that postmodernism, in the forms that we have it from Jacques Derrida, from Michel Foucault, and from Jean-François Lyotard, all want to undercut the notion of a certain central true understanding of texts or even of language. So let's just take an example that probably will make sense to all of our listeners, though it sounds a little hoity-toity at first. The postmodern philosopher Jacques Derrida, who died just a few years ago, spoke dismissively about our logocentric culture, or about the logocentrism of Western culture. And by that, he meant that the notion of logos is at the very center of Western culture, and he felt it needs to be gotten rid of. He used some fancy terminology for that. But he meant we should stop being logocentric. I think his first target was plainly Jesus himself and the scriptures. So in what we could probably regard as a guiding Bible passage for our discussion today, we know that in John 1, verse 14, the Apostle John tells us that Jesus, the Logos, became incarnate and tabernacled for a while among us, and in him we've seen the glory of the only begotten. So the first thing Derrida wants to do is to get rid of Christ. But an interesting come-along is that he's also getting rid of the Greek understanding that there is a logic or a logos-like orderly character both to our minds and toward the universe in which we live. So how about if I toss in a quick example that I'm going to use, even though I probably shouldn't quite fess up to it on air. In my introductory logic classes, it used to be that since I knew it was going to be kind of a hard sell to explain to people, my undergraduates, why it was going to be important to study all of the stuff we study in classroom logic, I mentioned to them rather deliberately on the first day that logic is very, very important and critical for human life, but this is a philosophy course, so you can object to things. And I would watch for a student who was looking a little skeptical about my saying that logic is central to us being human beings together. And I'd kind of egg him or her on a little bit by another comment or two until, you know how sincere college freshmen are. I would say, so it looks like you really want to object to that. And that person would say yes. And I'd say, well, that's great. How about for our next class, if I give you the first 5 or 10 or 15 minutes of class and you can explain to us why logic is not important and why we shouldn't have to do it? Well, the dutiful freshman would come. I actually had some folks who would come, you know, with a typed out outline or presentation that they would read off explaining, get this, why we don't need logic in an extremely logical form. So this really can't be avoided on pain of being incoherent, right? So Derrida's, the postmodern project's effort to get logos out of things actually means throwing out the baby with the bathwater, and in their efforts to get rid of Christ, they're actually telling us that there is nothing coherent or meaningful or trustworthy in language or our thinking together at all, which is, of course, self-falsifying. It's pulling the rug out from under themselves and all of us at the same time.
Briefly on that, Dr. Scholes, why do the postmodernists focus, and I agree with you, their real target is Christ himself, but why go after language, texts, words?
I wonder, Todd, maybe you have some thoughts on this too. I think in Derrida's case, I spent some time with a presentation at our nearby University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee on this 2 months ago for our campus ministry. Derrida actually speaks at great length about why he likes the idea of a Messiah, but he doesn't accept that you could ever identify a particular Messiah because he thinks that's, well, too logocentric, you know. So I would think that there probably is a desire to be free from Christ when anybody in Western culture wants to get rid of the logos. Reminds me, doesn't it remind you and our listeners of Psalm 2, where the people, could we paraphrase and say the philosophers and professors, to take counsel against the Lord and against his anointed, and they want to throw off his chains of the gospel or perhaps any of his claims on us. I also think, as a philosopher, that this is just cuteness and wittiness gone out of control like a huge brush fire. So it's one thing to be able to say clever things in a graduate class or after class that undercuts everything anybody's saying. But when you do that as a career and when you go into classrooms and into print saying that sort of thing, for some reason it seems to take on a life of its own, and these folks just can't stop doing it. I also think, since I'm not a psychologist but a philosopher, that I'm simply going to say that it appears to be that a person just takes a lot of delight in doing things that corrode our responsibility. So the way this comes down the line in kind of a trickle-down postmodernism is it turns out to be a license not to think and not to read for us professors in the regular university classrooms and for those of us in the seats and their parents and so forth.
You say, and this is the principal subject of our conversation, that the best way to respond to the corrosive and anti-intellectual outcomes of postmodernism is actually to go back to good old Aristotle and what he called acts of the mind, three acts of the mind. Get us started there, if you would.
Sure, I'd be glad to. First, I'm going to say that these three acts of the mind, which look extremely commonsensical, really do flow from Aristotle. And I would take it that, you know, if we put Aristotle where he is about 350 BC, the time of Alexander the Great, actually Aristotle's thinking on this was very formative and informative for practically everybody down the line in at least Western culture until the modern period when Aristotle was thrown out the window. So what we have is this. Aristotle's three acts of the mind take our understanding and use of language as being the way we think and what we do together, and observe that really there are three, no more and no fewer, but three fundamental acts of the mind that show up when we are talking, writing, and thinking well. So they're called in truly inspired form the first, the second, and the third act of mind. So the first act of the mind is our activity of understanding. The second act of the mind is our activity of judging. And the third act or activity of the mind is our activity of reasoning. A good way to think about it is that in the first act of the mind, which has to do with understanding, we need to be sure that everybody in the conversation understands what the key terms mean. In the second act of the mind, we're operating at the level of sentences, which are declarative sentences that give us the opportunity and even necessitate our judging things to be true or false. So our statements are being judged to be true or false. And then third act of the mind has to do with lines of argument for which our goal is honest, clear, valid reasoning together. It's also possible just to think about those grammatically. So first act of the mind has to do with words or terms, get them clear. Second act of the mind with judgment has to do with sentences, like a thesis sentence for a good paragraph. It should be true. And reasoning has to take place according to patterns or ways of doing things that maintain and bring to light the truth.
So there we're talking about essentially words, statements, and then I guess you might say arguments in their most basic form.
Yes.
Why is this so necessary? Before we go into some more detail on those, why is this so necessary, a response to postmodernism?
Well, because this is the way language and people in language actually do operate. So despite the cynicism or the studied hopelessness of the postmodern notion, this is a quote from Lyotard, one of the other people I mentioned briefly. He says, simplifying to the extreme, in postmodernism, we are altogether incredulous of any meta-narrative, which is a fancy way of saying that the postmodern conviction is that there is no grand overall story and no meaning to be had anywhere. So I would say that the thing is to go ahead and actually use language and find out or demonstrate that, in fact, language is very meaningful, and that when we use it thoughtfully and honestly together, it does everything that the postmoderns want to deny to us. So we actually can, if we have conversations together or even emails back and forth, we can actually come to understandings of important terms that everybody shares. And we actually can practice judgments about particular statements or propositions. And then, of course, as long as we're patient with each other and not just trying to take snapshots of life, but taking it as it really is, then we get to talk together about that stuff and sort out whether our reasoning is solid or if we have to go back to the drawing board or back to the conversation for another run at understanding.
Dr. Gregory Scholz is our guest. We're beginning a series today on Christianity and logic. Today we're talking about the three acts of the mind. He's professor of philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin, and author of the book, The Problem of Suffering, Father's Hope. We'll be right back.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Even if your child has mild to moderate autism, learning disabilities, attention difficulties, or other learning challenges, he can receive a classical Christian education. The Simply Classical curriculum was created by Issues Etc. guest Cheryl Swope, an author, educator with a master's degree in special education, and homeschooling mother of twins with special needs. The Simply Classical curriculum has become an answer to prayer for parents and schools. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and save $5 with the coupon code LPR.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
At Redeemer Lutheran Church in Fort Wayne, we are mostly looked down upon by cool people. They're always telling us that we take ourselves too seriously. That apparently is the uncoolest thing on the planet. We are theological nerds. We get more incensed by bad exegesis than a group of comic book fans who find out the hero was just dreaming. Some people want us to calm down, but we aren't going to. Redeemer, Fort Wayne, haven for theological nerds.
You can support the boys' basketball program at Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, by entering a team into our annual Golf Scramble fundraiser. It's Saturday, May 28th, at Oakbrook Golf Course in Edwardsville. Hi, this is Anthony Smith, head boys basketball coach at Metro East Lutheran High School. Join me and fellow Knights for a golf scramble May 28th at Oakbrook Golf Course. For more information, send me an email, anthony.smith@melhs.org. Thanks for your support.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're beginning a series on Christianity and logic. Today we're talking about the three acts of the mind. Dr. Gregory Schultz is our guest, professor of philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin. Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. They make it much easier for you to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree. You can find out more at issuesetc.org. Just click the Concordia University, Wisconsin online logo, enter the promo code ISSUES, and they'll waive your application fee. Lifelong Lutheran Learning, Concordia University, Wisconsin online. Dr. Schultz, before the break, you were talking about these simple acts of the mind, the definition, making statements, and formulating arguments of just how, that's just how language works, you said. Does that explain why even the bright lights of postmodernism that deny all of those things end up writing books and academic papers that are full of words and sentences and definitions and statements and arguments despite themselves?
Right. Let's not miss that. So that's why I said it's, you know, it's self-falsifying to say that there's no such thing as meaning, because you're assuming some meaning in the saying of that, just as probably next time we'll discuss how it's self-falsifying to say there's no such thing as truth.
Give us an example, if you would, kind of the one, two, three, the three acts of the mind, a simple example that we can understand, broken down into those three acts.
Well, sure. I'm going to take the chance, Todd, to say that there are some terms that I think all of your listeners would agree are terms that we need to stop and discuss what they mean before we go on to the important conversations that follow, just for a quick battery of important examples on first act of the mind. So terms such as abortion, what does that really mean? Terms such as the human being, as in our discussion that all human beings are entitled to human rights, and so forth. So we've got some big, big terms, marriage, among others, that need to be defined as part of our national conversation or our over-coffee conversations at home or at work. How about if we consider that statement that all human beings are entitled to human rights? So for first act of the mind, we would need to talk about what is meant by human beings, or by man, if you prefer the older way of talking about it. So we would need to talk there about our understandings of the human being, not just from the natural sciences, which may address our physical or bodily being in some detail, but the human being in terms of mind, the human being in terms of her social relatedness to other human beings, that sort of thing. I might say that actually this is also extremely useful, for instance, for my students. Had one student in my office just a little less than an hour ago explaining that she had difficulties handling an essay, which was a requirement to get into a course of study, but that after working with the first act of the mind, she realized that what she needed to do first and foremost was define the key terms and then go on to writing the rest of the essay. So let's go back to our sentence that all human beings are entitled to human rights. Maybe that would even get cast as a discussion about the term person. A fascinating thing about the word person is that despite the way it's used today to discount some people from being human beings, the word person really comes from the Trinitarian conversation, trying to figure out how best to talk about the biblical fact that God is one God and yet three, what shall we say, Father, Son, Holy Ghost, three persons. So from all persons or all human beings are entitled to human rights, in that statement now we've got a judgment. And if our understanding of person or human being and also rights are clear, we can judge that to be a true statement. maybe somebody would go on to say, but I don't think that human beings who aren't born should count as persons or have human rights, or I don't think that disabled persons or cognitively disabled persons should have human rights the way other people do or whatever. That's where the reasoning comes in. And I would notice that a lot of that could have to do with understanding those terms in the first place. For reasoning, it's customary in the textbooks to talk about things like syllogisms, you know, those little mini arguments, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. But I recommend that we think of this rather as the minding the gap in the area between our claim in the proposition and the evidence we give for it. So we're really talking about understanding the words that we're using, making a clear statement of fact so we know what it is we're going to discuss, and then actually having a reasonable conversation about that.
What we're really talking about, not only a way to counteract postmodernism, but we're talking about, as we said before, what postmodernists themselves do in spite of themselves. So just kind of a curious question here. When you read a postmodernist who's trying to argue against meaning, does he define his terms? He shouldn't, but does he?
I'm going to use one particular example so that I'm maybe not guilty of the straw man argument, you know, where you set up your opponent in a convenient form to knock down. So I mentioned that lecture I had concerning Derrida. Derrida offered a quote on what he thought marriage should be once Western society was able to get rid of the religious notion of marriage from the Bible. And in that, he said that marriage should be a contractual union of whatever number of people for whatever period of time and for whatever reason they wanted. Now, what I'd notice is that that, quote, definition is really not a definition of marriage in any intelligible sense. And secondly, that I'm not sure it's a definition of anything. So there is still the push or the inertia for defining terms, but they're being defined or described in such odd and wild ways that it's pretty plain that the first act of the mind is being utterly ignored there.
Well, that leads us to kind of when this is done well and when it's done poorly. When these three acts of the mind are done well, what should kind of be the criteria by which we judge each one of these things in terms of words, statements, arguments?
Yeah, that's good. I do think that we can put a lot of trust in simply talking back and forth thoughtfully and honestly. Now, language is, as we say in 20th century philosophy, a given for us as human beings. I think that the richer account of language is, of course, that it's a given from God. We find God speaking things into being those first 6 days of creation, and then we find Adam and Eve speaking right away. So what I think we should notice is that as a given, or as a gift from God, better put, language is subject to all sorts of abuses. Now, that's certainly the case. But the abuse doesn't mean that you get to toss out the use of this gift of God. So that's why I have mentioned a couple times that we need to be thoughtful and honest in our conversations. I think that we can put a very high level of trust in people who really want to understand what the words mean, coming to that shared understanding. You know, so somebody's going to look up a dictionary definition on her smartphone, and somebody else is going to mention a quote from Shakespeare, and somebody else is going to talk about how they heard that term used yesterday. And you can bring that all together. In terms of the second act of the mind, judgment, that depends on the first act. I think that maybe 90% of the time that things go off the rails for essays that I grade or for conversations that, you know, we're all part of, I think 90% of the time it's because the first act of the mind isn't attended to. But then you can go on to the second act with the judging. We are looking to find out whether the things that we say to each other are true or false. And then, again, assuming that goodwill and a basic honesty and time, we can also have the arguments, as you said, or the longer conversations where we check out our reasoning, ask each other questions back and forth, and come to a shared understanding as to why that statement is true.
I want to give you, with a few minutes left to us, I want to give you an example of something people will hear almost every day or have heard very recently. And if you would, tell us whether or not it honors these three acts of the mind, clear definition of words, clear and true statements, and then valid arguments. And the term that's tossed around, you're familiar with it as well, Dr. Schultz, is marriage equality. We think we know what both those words mean and what they might mean together, but when tested, we often discover, Christians often discover, they mean the opposite of what we think they mean.
Yeah.
Talk about that, if you would.
Sure. So I suppose the way things often go for us, huh, especially through mass media, but then sometimes in hurry-up comments where people want to make their point and move on or make their point and get mad, somebody says something like, so do you believe in marriage equality? And you're supposed to say yes or no. Well, I would say just wait a minute, let's be more human and more sincere about this. Isn't the first thing to ask, well, I'd love to talk with you about that. What do you understand by marriage? And then what do you mean by equality? So that I can answer intelligently. I would offer the thought, as I was saying with that Derrida discussion I started a few minutes ago, that not everybody gets to use whatever bizarre definition for marriage that they want to. You've got to give some bona fides, some footnotes, some, you know, context and understanding that goes beyond what apparently the Supreme Court in the U.S. was doing recently. Though, by the way, I think if you look at the Supreme Court decisions on that matter, you'll notice that they were waffling about first act of the mind and even saying that they didn't want to define marriage. So the next term with equality would ask, you know, what exactly are we talking about? Are we talking about husbands and wives being equal before the Lord, which is a great passage from St. Paul, or are we talking about some sort of imposed standard of economic equality or exactly the same amount of time to talk during the day or getting exactly the same treatment for some reason on, oh, I don't know, taxes or whatever. So only when those terms are honestly and in some depth agreed upon can we go on to begin to answer that question if we're at all serious about conversation. The survey that just says, are you in favor of marital equality, yes or no, is not a survey. It's just some sort of gimmick. We need real conversation on these three acts of the mind.
Finally, then, you have three questions that you say we need to habitually ask when it comes to these three acts of the mind. That is just to engage in conversation with another person on an equal playing field. The three questions are, what do you mean, what is your point, and why? Why those three questions?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, there are a number of worthwhile textbooks, not nearly as many as one would hope for, where people are paying attention to that longer understanding of logic in Western history, not just in philosophy, but in the Western conversation. So some of these questions we can find in Peter Kreft, a current thinker out at Boston College, in his book Socratic Logic, which I very much appreciate and like, though I've offered a different form for the third act of the mind. And I would like to think that probably our listeners are realizing that this just sounds extremely straightforward. Some of my students have said, how come nobody taught us this early on? We really should have made this part and parcel of our education as homeschoolers or grade school and high schoolers. Do you know, too, I think we can also tack on the reminder for some of our Lutheran listeners to the program that a great deal of Luther's and then Chemnitz's and the other Orthodox Lutheran theology writing, a lot of that stuff exhibits the three acts of the mind. You can often find that the table of contents to books on the Trinity or on Christ and his two natures actually begin with defining the key terms and only then move on to the content of the propositions and the reason why, for instance, Jesus is both God and man, but in one person. So it's, you know, it's just really important all the way through.
Dr. Gregory Schultz is professor of philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin. He's author of the book, The Problem of Suffering, A Father's Hope. Dr. Schultz, thank you very much for being our guest.
My pleasure, Todd. Looking forward to the second one on truth.
When we come back, we're going to spend some time with Pastor Tom Baker of the radio show Law and Gospel. We'll be teaching a Sunday school lesson. Today, Jesus teaches us to pray in Luke chapter 11.
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by two things, the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. James Buescher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served, but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us, broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifests the love of Christ in our love for one another and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155.
Would you like to help a college or seminary student attend the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference? You can purchase a conference scholarship for a contribution of $100 to Issues Etc. You can donate online at issuesetc.org/scholarship. Or you can make your $100 check payable to Issues Etc. Write Scholarship in the memo line and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234.
What would you say if someone asked you to explain the Trinity? Would you begin with Scripture, the creeds, or some clever analogy? And how are Christ and the gospel at the center of this fundamental Christian teaching? Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Carl Beckwith has written a new book in the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic series. It's titled The Holy Trinity. You can save $5 by pre-ordering The Holy Trinity at logia.org, L-O-G-I-A.org.
Your lifeline to the Lutheran worldview. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you have a student finishing up eighth grade at a Lutheran school? Do you wish there were a Lutheran high school close to where you live so your student could continue going to a Lutheran school? What if there was an opportunity for high school students in public or Lutheran school to take classes like Latin, logic, and hard-hitting theology courses? Well, there is. It's called Wittenberg Academy, the first completely online classical Lutheran high school. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
Have you recently graduated from high school or college and are still making up your mind about your future career? Here's an opportunity to serve your neighbor through an extended, uniquely Lutheran service program. It's called the Lutheran Youth Corps. Find out more about the Lutheran Youth Corps at lcms.org/youthcorps. Life together through witness and mercy, the Lutheran Youth Corps, lcms.org/youthcorps.